I'm Joe, an alcoholic. It's a privilege to be here. As in all AA meetings, I identified with both Vicki and Emmett. Emmett, I'm a guy who, after a couple of drinks, always get that call to return to nature. Also, you know, I didn't live in South Central, but I lived in the Valley. But you know, and Van Nuys in July. You know, it gets pretty warm there. You know, after a heavy couple of days of drinking, my neighbors would be getting calls about the naked jogger, you know. I want to thank Lindsay for this great privilege. Charlie always talks about the paradox of alcoholism, where you're ambitious, but you can't get off the couch, or you renounce God, but you ask Him to get you just get you out of this one, you know. And being asked to speak at this meeting is sort of a sober paradox for me, because I've been in this group for all of my sobriety, and it's a great honor and privilege. And for many years, I lusted after being a speaker at this meeting. But the minute the speaker asks, you know, you go, "Oh my God, now what?" You know. And I'll be glad when the 40 minutes are up, so I can go back to eating solid food again, you know. the winning habits that I have developed in this group have come from, you know, the rituals that are important to us all here, the things that we do consistently week after week. And I think the favorite of those rituals has always been for me is thanking the speaker after the Wednesday night meeting. But I'll get back at you, because you can't get out. You're trapped. As far back as I can remember, I did not particularly like who I was sober. I felt inadequate. I felt like I didn't fit in. All those things you hear from podiums. And the first time I drank alcohol, it changed all that. You know, alcohol was my solution right from the very beginning. It allowed me to be whoever I wanted to be. You know, it allowed me to fit in. I craved acceptance. I wanted to be one of the guys. I wanted to be an important person. I wanted to be recognized. I wanted to be somebody that did well in whatever I did. And I never really felt that way. I mean, I had a lot of breaks when I was growing up, but I never felt, like Clint talks about, everything that happened, every A I got, every touchdown I scored, I always asked myself, is that all there is, you know? And when I drank alcohol, that was all I needed, you know? It worked for me, you know? Because alcohol was my solution, I drank like a pig right from the very beginning. I remember someone describing their early drinking career, and identified with this. They said they would look around, and people would be into something totally different than they were. They were at a party and just happened to be drinking, and I was drinking and just happened to be at a party. You know, that described my drinking right from the beginning. You know, when you drink like that, you know, there's consequences. At first, you know, I would puke on your shoes or park my car on your lawn, you know. But as time went along, as I, you know, that alcoholism took hold in my life, you know, I violated every moral imperative, everything that I said that I wouldn't do, I did in order to keep drinking. It wasn't long before, like the book says, I could not predict what I was going to do, you know, when I drank. And I did a lot of things that I did not plan to do. That was the hallmark of my alcoholism. And those consequences, you know, I was the king of the one car traffic accident. You know, I. I saw a few of those alcoholic cars out there in the parking lot, you know. One headlight pointed straight up in the sky, you know. The fenders in the shape of a parking garage bumpers, you know. Or a shrubbery all in the fenders, you know. I wanted to have a girlfriend. I remember when I was in high school, but you know, my behavior when I was drunk made that kind of hard to accomplish. I mean, girls seldom go out on second dates with somebody that rolls a car on 90 miles an hour the first time out. Actually, later on, I found out there were whole rooms full of them. They would have just loved it. But I didn't know that then. And, you know, I mean, it was important for me to keep drinking, you know, throughout. And there was a lot of evidence. As I drank, there was a lot of evidence that alcohol was a problem in my life. And, you know, the hallmark of my disease is that I ignore that evidence as it piled up and became more and more evident. You know, I was an alcoholic. I like to alternate liquor stores. You know, I would go into a liquor store and I'd kind of, Evelyn talks about this a little bit, I did the same thing where I would do that little dance down the aisle and pick up the potato chips, you know, and the cat food. And I never had a cat, you know. And I would turn around, and this one night I was in this liquor store, and I turned around and headed for that counter, you know, and this guy was standing at the counter, and he reached behind him, and he picked up that cheap quart of vodka, and he put it on that counter, you know, and I didn't have to say a word, man. I hated that guy, you know. Oh, man. Because he knew, you know, he knew how much I needed that stuff. I needed alcohol to do everything in my life, you know, and even though it was, you know, it had long since turned from a solution into a problem, you know, I continued to drink, and I continued to blame other people for the way I felt, you know, because it was your fault, you know. It was those parents, you know, if they'd have just given me more as I was growing up, and later on, it was that principal at school, you know, if he'd have just given me a break. Or that the boss at work, you know, if he'd have just given me that promotion, you know, that wife, if she'd have just loved me more, then I wouldn't be feeling the way that I feel, you know. And I stumbled from one crisis to another. My emotions were always out of control, you know. And I always was willing to point the finger at you and blame you for the way I felt. There was a lot of evidence that alcohol was a problem in my life. I mean, there was new items in my budget, like bail and attorney fees, you know, that were popping up. And I was a blackout drunk. You know, I was a time traveler from long ago. You know, I would wake up 30 miles from where I remember being last, you know, and that didn't happen just once. That happened night after night after night, you know. Like I said, there was all of this evidence, you know, that was pointing that I was an alcoholic out of control. And I it took a lot of rationalization. It took a lot of keen alcoholic denial. I denied the reality of my life because I did not want to give up alcohol. I did not want to give up that one thing that I felt was a solution. That one thing that worked, that one thing that made me feel, that I could deal with these emotions, deal with the world, you know, the realities of the world. And, that evidence, there was, like I said, I would wake up at facing the wrong way on the side of a freeway abutment, you know, time after time. And, I always thought I was a better driver when I was drinking. You know, I asked one time this guy that pulled me over. I says, "You know, how did you spot me?" He says, well, it wasn't really too hard. You were going about 3 miles an hour up on the sidewalk. You know, I ended up in that drunk tank. You know, I'd come to in that drunk tank one more time, and I the last thing I remember was sitting at home in that greasy vinyl chair. Trying to figure things out, trying to analyze my life, wondering what was wrong with me, wondering why I couldn't get a break. You know, I mean, there was a lot of opportunities that were handed to me in my life. But I was always drunk. I was always running away. I was always afraid. When it was important for me to be alert and sober, you know, in order to seize the opportunity, I was afraid and hiding and blaming other people for my problems. You know, that was a pattern in my life, and that was one of those. Things when I got here that I continued to do. You know, I had a lot of ideas about how to be a successful person. You know, that I had picked up through my alcoholic odyssey. You know, even though I felt inadequate, even though I yearned to talk to somebody about the way I felt. You know, I adopted this cynical, sarcastic exterior that just kept you away. You know. I was very isolated when I got here to Alcoholics Anonymous. I pushed my family away, and anybody that tried to love me, well, you know, shame on you, you know, because if you get too close to me, I'm going to have to hurt you, you know. And I tried everything. I tried all of the things that, you know, that I thought would work. You know, I tried, you know, to accumulate a lot of stuff like Barney talks about. You know, I tried church and self-help books and all of the therapies that I could think of to do, you know. I mean, I even one night I was sitting. I was a phoner, you know. After sitting home till 3 a.m., I knew that girl that had rejected me 10 years ago was waiting for that call, you know. And sometimes, if I couldn't get my message through, I put in a personal appearance right at her doorstep, you know. Couple times her husband and one of her three kids would answer, and I know that I might be a little too late here, you know. I wasn't just in denial, you know, where I wasn't facing reality in my life. I was changing the reality in my life to fit my own, you know, thinking. You know, I'm an alcoholic that's in love with love, you know, and I knew this night that the only reason that I wasn't doing well is that I didn't have a wife. You know, if I just had a wife. You know, I looked around at people at work and people that I admired, and they seemed to all have wives and they seemed to have kids and all that stuff. You know, and so of course I went out that night looking for a wife. Where does an alcoholic look for a wife? In a bar, of course. You know, I found her the first night. You know, this wasn't going to be a long search. You know. She had a broken arm. I liked that right away. Fed into my Sir Galahad complex, you know. And we had an alcoholic whirlwind courtship of 10 days. And at the end of that 10 days, you know, I knew that this was the answer. You know, I knew that this relationship was the thing that I had been looking for all my life, you know. Because, you know, I had never really been able to sustain a relationship. Like I said, alcohol always made my choices, you know. Alcohol chose, how far I was going to get on a job. Alcohol chose what woman I was going to be with. Alcohol chose what hobby I was going to do, you know. And this was the first time that I felt like I had really connected, you know, because I was not connecting with people, you know. I was like an island. There's no one else in my life, you know, when I met this woman. And after 10 days, the only argument we got into was whether we were going to get a quart or a half gallon. And I knew this was real love, you know. So we got married, and like I said, we bought this little house in Burbank. And when we moved in there, the police didn't have a regular car coming down that street, but shortly thereafter, you know. You know, and we tried our best, you know, but, you know, I was just not capable of having a relationship with anybody. I mean, you know. And after that marriage, I mean, I had a series of relationships. The only criteria for me for a relationship was how do you look on my arm? You know, I'm not a real deep guy. You know what I mean? I'm pretty shallow when it comes to women, and that was it. You know, and as a result, I had a series of relationships with women that were a cross between Kim Basinger and Freddy Krueger. You know. And you know, I kept drinking, and I kept stumbling from one crisis to another, and you know, always, like I said, pointing my finger at the other people in my life, and wondering why I couldn't get a break, wondering why I couldn't be a success in life, and trying my best to put things together, like it says in chapter 5, and I just couldn't ever hold things, you know, long enough. It would just dissolve, you know, everything in my life would just fall apart, and you know, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and you know, for the first time in my life, you know, I came to this group. I was you know, so fortunate, and yet I still had some reservations about my alcoholism, and I continued to drink after coming to meetings here. You know, I mean, I progressed to a new level of denial, you know. Because once I got here and I saw that Alcoholics Anonymous was working for you, I never had another drink that would shut that feeling away. You know, I knew that there was some hope. I knew that people here were getting better and that there was something going on. And yet I continued to drink, you know, because I just did not, you know, I just kept denying that I was an alcoholic. You know, I knew that I was going to, you know, find that God was going to come down and work a miracle in my life, you know. And somehow I was going to be cured, you know. And I didn't, you know. After I got here, you know, especially, like I said, I was fortunate to come to this group, and you know, there was in my life. I mean, I was like a hermit. I had to cut people off, and the thing that you know, I loved about this group right away was that you know, there was some activities here, that there were some social things that helped me to kind of fit back into the world. And I loved the fact that there was a New Year's Eve party here. I mean, I think the first time that I really felt like I belonged somewhere that I can really think of is the first New Year's Eve party in this group, you know. And I looked around after I'd been here for about 7 months, and the people, you know, I looked around and I knew a lot of people by their name, and I felt comfortable, and I felt safe, and I felt like I fit in this group. And you know, I learned a lot. I went to the yard, you know, and I still go, you know, 23 years later. I mean, I love the yard. It's a place that I can just, you know, be myself. I can just get rid of the problems, you know. I can just kind of act out, and it's been a wonderful part of my sobriety ever since I got here. And you know, I learned about teamwork. I learned about my character defects at Watches. You know, I mean, I wanted to, you know, I was used to just talking all about myself, and at Watches I learned that I had to, you know, listen to you. You know, there was a great thing here, that was happening to me after I got to the Pacific Group, and that was that I was changing. You know, and you know, I realized, you know, it's funny though, the outside of my life was changing. In other words, that was getting better, but inside I really wasn't changing that much. I mean, I was coming here and I was going to a lot of meetings, and but there was a lot of things that I wasn't doing to improve my inside. I mean, I realized that I was an alcoholic, and I knew that that, you know, my problems were that I drank too much, you know. And great, I realize that now. I'm really happy to know that information, and now I can get on with being a success, you know. Now I can get on with the business of really doing well in life, you know. And for me, you know, with some of the things that I believed when I got here was that material things were important, you know. And like I said, I wanted that pretty blonde on my arm, and so I immediately started going toward those goals, you know. And I knew that, you know, that if I got those things, that I was going to be happy. And you know, I have radar. I found the sickest one in the room, and you know, immediately. And you know, I followed her around, and One weekend when my sponsor was out of town, I decided this was the right thing to do. We should get married real quick here. And just a coincidence, you know. We look good on the outside, you know, which is, you know, like I said, that was my big criteria. And I'd come to meetings and people would ask me how you're doing. I'd say, hey, I'm doing fine. Are you kidding? Look at that big car out there. You know, look at this great looking suit I'm wearing. You know, look at that pretty blonde I'm wearing too. Man, I'm doing great. And when we were home alone in that house, there wasn't a whole lot of communication going on. We really didn't have anything in common. And I couldn't really talk about that. I had a sponsor, and I really I admired him, and I wanted to impress him. I didn't. When I did my inventory, I kind of left out a few of those tackier things that I had done when I was drinking, and I wasn't really talking very honestly with this guy because I didn't really trust him. I couldn't just let go, you know, and so this marriage was going bad, and I was coming around here, and I was talking that talk, and I was very active, going to a meeting every night, and yet inside I had that same old fear, and I had that same old feeling that something was wrong, and I just couldn't talk about it, and the pressure started building, and the only thing I could do, because when I would come here, I would see people's lives changing, and I would see them getting better, you know, and I'd see my friends, you know, having good relationships and doing well in their jobs and having a good relationship with their sponsor and working the steps, you know, and I knew that I had not been honest with about that inventory, so I stopped going to meetings for a while, you know, this just because I couldn't talk about what was going on inside my Eskimo. Claude, who's here tonight, after a couple of months of me not going to meetings, he lured me out of my house, you know, by inviting me for a pizza, and he took me over to Ohio Street, and I got over into that meeting, and it was that Sunday night meeting, and they asked me to come up to that podium and share, and I, for the first time ever, I talked about how I was really doing, you know, how I felt like a failure in Alcoholics Anonymous, how I knew, you know, that another relationship had failed, and that I just couldn't fit in here. I couldn't make it here, and I expected you guys to turn your backs on me and laugh at me and say, hey, you know, get out of here. We just don't want to hang out with you, you know. But you know what happened? People came up and hugged me and said welcome, you know, and said and told me that that I was just another alcoholic, you know, and trying to do my best and. That was the beginning of my real steps in my real journey into Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, from that night on, I worked the second. I was 8 years sober at the time, and I worked the second part of the first step. You know, where I admitted my life was unmanageable, and I started to go back. And you know, I had a lot of attitudes and a lot of concepts about how to live life, like real men don't talk about their feelings and don't ask for help and feelings are facts and you got to analyze your problems, you know, and get your thinking all straightened out and material things are important. You know, I had all these things that I knew about being a success in life and one by one I started to I worked that honest inventory finally, and I took that drive with that sponsor, and I knew that he was going to reject me and turn his back on me, and instead he shared some things that made the hair on the back of my neck stand up. You know, it was gave new meaning to animal husbandry. I'll tell you that. You know, and I learned that. All those things that I did when I was drinking, I did those things to earn my seat here, to get here to Alcoholics Anonymous and to surrender and to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I always felt like a moral leper, like, I was too sick to fit in here and I'd done too many weird things. You know, I knew, like Clancy says, you know, I knew that if there was a God, that I was screwed because I had violated every single, moral imperative that, that I had set for myself. You know, I had you know, like Clint talks about, you know, there was that gap between, I knew I was a good person, you know, and I always felt that I was a good person. I was brought up in a good home and given a set of values, and, you know, as I drank, and even in my sobriety, you know, my definition of what a good person it was and my behavior were growing farther and farther apart, you know. And when I was drinking that, you know, that kept me out there drinking, you know, because I knew that I was just too sick, you know, to be helped, too sick to find a solution to, you know, my alcohol had always been my solution and it had deserted me and I had not replaced it with anything, you know. And when I finally surrendered, when I finally applied the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous to my life, I found that you know, I fit in here. For the first time, I found a place where I was accepted, where I was you know, I was a friend among friends, where and I was a good member of this group, and that, you know, that really was a something that you know, I had always lusted since I'd gotten to Alcoholics Anonymous. I wanted to be a big time circuit speaker, and I wanted to sponsor everybody and be a secretary of all the meetings, you know. But I found you know, that my place here is just in another seat in Alcoholics Anonymous, in this group, you know. This group has made a big change in my life. I mean, the activities kept me sober here for a long time, and but there's a lot of good sobriety here. There's a lot of good action here, you know, that helps me to keep my emotions under control, you know. Because I have to change the way that I live when I was drinking. I have to uncover, discover, and discard, you know. And all of those attitudes that I had when I was drinking, I've had to one by one look at those things, you know. That relationships that I had that were so painful to me that I couldn't sustain. About 12 years ago, I met this gal over at Ohio Street, and we kind of hit it off, and she was from Boston, which was God's little cosmic joke on me. You know, we had a lot of fun for a couple of weeks when she was here, and she went back home, and I found myself thinking about her a lot, and calling her and writing her letters, and you know, we, because of the distance between us, we developed a friendship, and you know, there was a lot about her, you know, which was kind of a strange, unique thing for me. I mean, I'm the kind of guy who circles your house at midnight, you know, just to make sure there isn't any strange cars out there, you know. And it's kind of hard to do from 3,000 miles away, you know. But, you know, I found myself, you know, kind of, and I would go back there at Christmas, and she'd come out here in the summer, and we'd spend some time together, and our friendship started to grow. And, you know, I found that I had a lot in common with her. You know, we could talk, you know, about the world, and you know, we had similar backgrounds, and we had a lot of same attitudes about life. And you know, I admired the way she was a good mother to her daughter, and her family was good, solid. And you know, as our relationship progressed, my definition of what a good relationship is sort of broadened out. And you know, after a couple of years of this bi-coastal relationship, we decided to get married, and she came out here, and you know, our home is full of Alcoholics Anonymous. She's a longtime sober member of AA, and that phone is ringing all the time. And she's you know, I love her very much, and you know, she's the best thing other than my sobriety that's ever happened to me, you know. I'm willing to change in order to keep her in my life. You know, she insists that I go first class, and you know, that's a real attraction to me. You know, but I tell you, last summer, just to show you something about my thinking. You know, I was having my car repaired, and she was supposed to pick me up, and it was about 105 degrees, and I'm dressed a little bit like I am now, and she's supposed to pick me up, and she's about 5 minutes late, and you know, it's pretty warm, and I'm starting to pace a little bit and mutter to myself, and another 5 minutes goes by, and I'm loosening my tie, and I'm thinking, you know, where the hell is she, you know? And another 5 minutes goes by, and I'm thinking, you know, that woman never loved me. A couple more minutes, I'm thinking, you know, my last two marriages, I gave up the house. You know, this time I'm getting the house, you know. Started making a mental list of all you lucky AA women that I was going to start dating that night, you know. So, you know, I mean, with this, that's the way I think, folks. You know, I used to make all my best decisions in that frame of mind, you know. One of the great benefits of this program has been the privilege of sponsoring people. You know, that has been something that saved me. You know, because when I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing to set an example for the people that I sponsor, you know, my life gets better. You know, like Clancy talks about, there's nothing that teaches me better than the sound of my own voice talking on the phone. You know. That's been that great thing that's kept me, involved and doing the things that I'm supposed to do, you know. But you know, those babies can really be a pain in the ass sometimes, you know. And one guy, you know, I couldn't believe it. He called me up and, actually, I was having this really bad day, and my boss had been screaming at me for the last 5 minutes and was telling me I'd kind of screwed up this one project, and he was telling me what a lousy employee I was and how, things are going to have to change and, that I better shape up. And he left my office and I was just fuming, you know. I'm thinking, God damn it, that guy, you know, this company would be nothing without me, you know. He doesn't appreciate what a quality employee I am. You know what? I could get a job anywhere. I'm going to go in there. I'm going to quit. You know what? I'm going to jump on his desk. I'm going to ram my fist right down his throat. So I'm heading out the door, you know, and just as I'm reaching the door, the phone rings, and I reach back and I pick it up, and it's one of those babies, you know, and that really whiny voice is, Joe, my boss just yelled at me. I feel like quitting. What should I do? Well, I got that sponsorial voice out, you know, well, you got a pretty good job there, and you had a family to support. Why don't you stay out of his way the rest of the day and make amends to wherever you need to and get to a meeting tonight, you know? You see how this baby's getting away, you know? You can actually learn something from people you sponsor, though. You know, a little after that, this guy called me up. He says, you know, I am feeling so awful. I said, I was really selfish last night. As soon as I finished making love to my wife, I just rolled over and went right to sleep. And I feel bad. I said, well, you ought to feel bad. You know, us 90s kind of guys, you know, we got to think of their needs, you know. And I pulled out that little speech that my wife wrote for me to tell him, you know. And the copy of New Woman magazine she gave me, you know, for reference. And I says, yeah, you know, you really got to think of her needs. You know, we just can't be selfish like we used to be when we were drinking. He says, it's awful. And he says, it was the fourth time we made love that night, and I was just so tired, you know. After a minute of total silence, I went, so tell me about your diet, you know. I've had to, everything I knew about life, I've had to unlearn here, you know. And I do it because I have good examples in this group. I mean, I am so fortunate to be a member of this group in good standing because, when I first came here, Joe Esef showed me what a friend was by coming and picking me up and taking me to meetings. And because of our friendship, I believe that I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and stayed here after I had drank. He showed me that, I was not unique. The two of us would spend hours and hours on end in the car driving. This guy came over 20 miles just to give me a ride to meetings, you know, and that was my first good example of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, the action that happens here, you know, goes way beyond just the activities, beyond the conventions and the New Year's Eve parties, you know, right into the heart of the steps, you know, where I learned to live and I learned to control those emotions, you know, that have been I have been the victim of my emotions all my life, you know, and this is the only thing that I have ever found, you know. I'm 23 years sober, and still the most important thing for me to do is to be in a meeting, you know, several times a week. And I still go to meetings, you know, because just listening to one drunk talking to another is, you know, and still identifying as an alcoholic, you know. I need to be where the new people is. I need to be where I can identify, where I can laugh at myself and the intensity levels that I reach during my day, you know. This is just the best deal I have ever had. You know, it's given me relationships. You know, when I got here, like I said, I was not connecting with people. I was isolated. I living in my own head and denying all that alcohol was a problem. And when I surrendered and I admitted that I was an alcoholic and that I was powerless over alcohol, that was the beginning of the best life I've ever had. I love the people in this group. I am really delighted that this is over with, and I am so privileged to be sober. It gives me a chance to have the best life I've ever had, and thank you for listening.
The Pacific Group is an open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all members of the community are welcome to attend. The single most important aspect of AA recovery, however, is the principle of one alcoholic relating to another alcoholic. Therefore, only alcoholics actually participate in our meetings. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful to you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Good evening. My name is Claire, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
Welcome to the Pacific Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers, a coffee break, and a main speaker. Our first 10-minute speaker is Vicki H.
Hi, I'm Vicki, an alcoholic.
Hi.
I want to thank Lindsay for asking me to share tonight. It's an honor and it's a privilege. And I want to welcome the newcomer. You're in the right place. Just keep coming back, one day at a time. I'll tell you a little bit about what it was like. I was born in Kansas City, Missouri. For those of you that don't know it, Missouri is known as the Show Me State. You know, and as I was growing up, that's exactly how I acted, you know. You tell me this was red, and I'll say, show me. That was my attitude from the get-go. I had my first resentment when I was about 7 or 8 years old. I was looking at baby pictures when I was born with my parents. And on my picture, I was like 2 days old, and it said, baby Harden. And I asked my mother, why does it say baby Harden? Why didn't it say Vicki Harden? They said, we thought you were going to be a boy. You know, and that really just irritated me. You know, I knew they wanted a boy, you know, so I just never felt comfortable in that family, you know. When I was 8 years old, I had my first crush on Rusty Long. I can still remember it. that same year, I started saying bad words, and I got my mouth washed out with soap. And I was so embarrassed because Rusty would be there watching me get my mouth washed out with soap. And, you know, I did well, though, in school. And I had my first drink right after my grandmother died. She was like a second mother to me. And she died of cancer when I was 13 and a half years old. And within 6 months of that, I started smoking cigarettes. And I had my first drink. And that first drink was a combination of Boone's Farm apple wine, Ripple, and Spinata. It tasted horrible, but it did well. I don't remember much of the night. I went hitchhiking for the first time. Where I went, I have no idea, but I did get home. And I didn't start drinking from the get-go every day after that. I finished high school. The problem with me is since I was about 17 years old, I've been dying of cancer in my mind. You know, and looking back and doing inventories, I had when I was playing softball in high school, I didn't want to play in one game, and so I told my coach that I was dying of cancer. And, I love that story. I told it many times, even when I got here to the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. But, I ended up at the age of 19, I wanted to be a cop or I wanted to be a doctor. I knew that. And I didn't like blood. So it was kind of obvious. My counselor said, to be a police officer, and I started to go to college, and it was really rough taking one class and trying to pass it, you know. I would go home and I would drink. Now, this class was actually on television, too. The hard part is I would tape it, but I wouldn't look at it for weeks, so they would change the time of the program every week. And so I always got other things on this. Instead of human behavior, I got other things in history. I could never study for the test. So I could understand why I failed. And so it was really too rough taking one class and working full time. So I decided that instead of being a cop, I'd date a cop, you know. That was easier. And I found him, and he was 13 and a half years older than I was, which was fine. I was 19, I was like 30-year-old anyhow. So the problem with it is, well, we got engaged, which was really great. And I got pregnant. That was so-so. The down part is that he was married, and I didn't know it. So we had a little problem there, and we discussed it. And, you know, he wasn't leaving his wife. So for whatever reason, we elected to have an abortion. And, you know, that was when I was 19. And from 19 to 31, when I got to Doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, it was this one drunk after another. I stayed with him on and off for 10 years and two marriages. I'm pretty consistent. If I want something, I want it, and I'm going to stick with it. And, you know, my drinking, basically, I was a type that when I was drinking, if I'm not finished talking with you, don't leave. You know? Don't leave. And this police officer and I were having a disagreement about something I did, but I don't care. It wasn't my fault. And, well, actually it was. I didn't care. I wasn't finished talking. He was. He exited out of the apartment building, and I followed him. And, unfortunately, he took off, and I jumped in the hood of the truck. And, you know, it's not a smart thing to do. And he thought I was going to get off, so he accelerated. And I went flying about 30 feet. The next thing I knew, I woke up, and there was this cute paramedic, you know. And it was like, he's next. You know, that's... you know, I just had relationships on top of relationships. They blended sometimes, and I would forget. Sometimes, though, I would have little times where I would be waiting for him to show up for dinner for 6 months and couldn't figure out what happened, you know. Basically, you know, I just drank. I drank till I couldn't drink anymore. In 1983, I got to the Doors of Alcoholics Anonymous because I was arrested for a 502. And I was not ready for Alcoholics Anonymous. I barely remember anything from 1983. 6 years later, and a total car and a few other things in my past, I arrived here at the Doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've been sober ever since, and that was April 14th, 1989. You know, if you're new tonight, definitely get a sponsor. Come to the meetings, get a commitment, show up and suit up. I mean, the best thing for me was to get a sponsor and just listen to that sponsor. And I'm a pretty belligerent little person. You know, my first sponsor was Sherry H., and she told me to go left, and I went right. And I wonder why I was uncomfortable for 4 months of my sobriety, you know. And when I got here at Alcoholics Anonymous, for me, I was dying of cancer once again. And unfortunately, I had a few people take me to chemotherapy treatments I didn't have. You know, it's just... So, about 5 years ago, or 4 years ago, I had to go to the doctor, and they had to biopsy a node in my neck, a lymph node. And it was a slim chance it could be cancerous. And if I recall this right, my sponsor, Judy Ross, will let me know afterwards if I'm telling this story right. First off, it's got to be cancer because I deserve it because of all those lies. Second off, if I remember right, I was still into a lot of drama back in those days. But if I remember right, I gave permission to the doctor to give Judy my results. Why? Because, you know, if it was cancer, I was going to run. And if it wasn't cancer, I might say it was. You know, I still was not well. You know, I'm not a rocket to stardom in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I've been sober almost 9 years. And I wouldn't have a life today without it. You know, I've accomplished a lot of things, and I did a dream about 2 years ago. You know, I went and tried out for the Deputy Sheriff's Academy, and I made it. And for various reasons of physical health, I couldn't complete it. But, you know, it was, the amazing thing was two things about that. I started something and finished it. I'm not a finisher. Secondly, I passed a polygraph test and didn't lie. That was amazing. You know, they took me at my word, and that was amazing. You know, I almost lost my dad a few years ago, and I walked through that and I didn't have to drink. I walked through death recently, and with my niece's, a friend of my niece's, you know, and without a sponsor, I couldn't do this. The group and everyone else, and thank you for letting me share.
Thanks, Vicki. Our second 10-minute speaker is Emmett Tee.
Hello, my name is Emmett Dorsett, and I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to thank Nancy for inviting me to share tonight. It's an honor and privilege. I'd like to welcome my newcomers to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and tell you it does work one day at a time. I have a very long drunk log, so y'all will be stacked pocket all night if you will, if I talk all night. Most of my drinking I don't remember, which they call blackouts. And it was socially accepted in my home because my mother and my father was bootleggers. So some of you newcomers don't know about that. We made our own wine, our own homebrew, and we what we call white lightning. And that would give you a spiritual awakening. And I drank that stuff because my mother didn't bother me by drinking it, and I do believe from my very first drink that I was an alcoholic. But I didn't know it, and it took me a long time to figure it out. And I drank that stuff straight. We didn't have chasers in them days. We just drank it, get your jaw, and you shake it up, and see that the buds go to the top, and if the buds went to the top, that was a good white lightning. You know? And we bootleg a lot, and little did I know, when I was going to school, I didn't say my profession would be dealing with alcohol. You know? But I learned a lot about alcohol through my parents, my grandparents. And little did I know, I retired in 1993 from one of the largest liquor distributors in Los Angeles. That was my profession. And alcohol did for me, I guess, what the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is doing for me now. It made me feel good at times. It made me feel bad at times. And I don't ever want to forget my last drunk to the newcomers. Like I say, I started off blackout drinking. I do things that I knew what I was doing. And I'm easy to follow directions. I follow directions. My mother, I think I got peed at my mother. And I tried something. You know how we are. I was the only boy with three girls. And as far as I know, anybody in the family is an alcoholic as myself. And so I decided, I got a wild idea that if I set the house on fire, I won't be bothered with them no more. I tried that, and I guarantee you I haven't had a desire to set nobody's house on fire since. Because parents would give you a spiritual awakening in days. They would. My father would go out there and cut a tree down, and he would just weigh it out on you. And if it was child abuse, I had it. But thank God, come June, this June, I'm going to see my father, which is 90. He turns 90 in May. And we're going to have a little family reunion and get together and talk about what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like today. And it's a lot of fun doing that because a lot of the things I did when I was drinking, I don't know what I did. It's people who tells me what I used to be like. And I will never forget my last drunk. I was standing on the corner of 83rd and Bigger Road, which is not a good place to be standing. And I'd get down to wine. And if you want to really get here fast, you start drinking wine. I think it was I taking a bit of Swiss lemon, I think it was. I don't know exactly. And the next thing I remember, someone was shaking me, saying, "Sir, will you please fasten your seatbelt?" I was wet. I had a pair of thongs on and a t-shirt. And Pat Schwartz was in November. And you say, sir, you're now arriving in Kennedy International Airport. That's how powerful alcohol is. I left 83rd and Vigoureux in L.A. and wound up in New York City. But that didn't stop me from drinking. That did not stop me. I went to my mother. I got my sister called. My sister was living up in Connecticut at the time. I said, sis, will you come and get me? She said, where are you at? I'm saying, at Kennedy. Now, I'm standing around the airport. Everybody got overcoats on, long johns on. I got a suntan, big natural, and shorts on, and wet. But I was cool. But you know, the minute my sister picked me up, and I got across to, before I could get across the turnpike, I was begging her, and I was threatening her to jump out of that car. And she, please stop this car. I wanted a drink. That's how bad I wanted to drink. Now, I don't know how I got from 83rd and Vigoureux to New York City, but I could think of a drink. And they got me a drink of that wine and whatever they got me, and I kind of eased the shakes down, and then I could talk out of the side of my mouth then. And my mother came in, she seen me, she shook her head, and my sisters gave me a bath, and she said, I don't know how you got here, but I know how you leave it. My mother put me on a plane and sent me back to Los Angeles, and my mother didn't see me no more until 1970 after I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I walked in the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous in November 1969 to the newcomers had me necessary to take a drink of alcohol. Any mind holding come was from my very first meeting, because I got a sponsor. I have a home group, which is the Pacific group, and I follow a few suggestions around here. And I do the stuff around here they tell me to do, and it's been easy. Staying sober has been the easiest thing I ever did in my life, you know, because I didn't have a life prior to Alcoholics Anonymous. Today I have a beautiful life. You know, I have things that I don't like doing today, things I've been plagued with illness since 1993, and I don't like it, but I learned to accept it. Not once have I thought about taking a drink. Not once. Last week I was in the hospital, and I kind of lied to the doctor. Once in a while I tell a little white lie. But he said, are you nervous? I said, no, I'm just cold. But honestly, I told him, yeah, I'm nervous. And then after he said, I was having a little pain, and this is where you really had to put the pedal to the metal in this program. He said, what would you like? You're like an alcoholic, what would he like? You know, he's talking about all them funny-looking pills. And I said, no, thank you. If I take one of them pills, you will not have a hospital. You know, and I learned to say no to them other things because I never fooled with them, and alcohol did for me, well, what other stuff did to you guys. But today I'm very grateful for this Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And no matter what I've been through, all I have to do is get on the phone and call someone. And the phenomenon of that thing is when you don't call people, they get pissed off at you. Why didn't you call me? You know. And I learned today to call people, and I talk to people, I sponsor people, and I have a lot of fun around here. I do a lot of things that not in this particular group, outside of the group here, and I go places that I never thought to go. I go to friends' house. I made amends to some friends that swore they never let me in their home again. And I've been able to go in my father's home again. I've been accepted back in the family again. And this year we're all getting together, and I doubt if anybody be drinking. But if they do, so be it, because I'm used to being around alcohol. And I'm probably the only member in this group that drove a liquor truck and held meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, but I just put a bunch of cases of whiskey back there, and we get the big book and have a meet. And I worked downtown, so I loved working downtown because it was convenient. And I got to see a good diagnosis of this disease. And that guy would be sitting there, and he'd walk up to the truck, and he'd say, can I please just have one? And I could reflect on me how I wanted that drink. Sometimes I'd give him a drink and sometimes I wouldn't, you know. But I know I cannot drink. I don't know about anyone in this room. I know if I take a drink tonight, that would set off that phenomenon craving and I'd be right back out there again. I would not have a suit and tie tonight. I'd probably be buck naked. Because that was my pattern, to just roll. Because I thought clothes got in my way. And you don't walk out on Vigoureux and stop a police car thing that should yell a cab, neither. And I did weird things that I remember now. That sleep with one hand in front of me and one hand behind me when I was in jail. And the guys say they want what you got. I have had to go through a lot of things since I've been sober. But most of all, I had a good life in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's been through God, as I understand it, that's given me a life. Thank you. Keep coming back.
And for every 365 days of continuous sobriety, we give a cake with the appropriate number of candles on it. We define sobriety as freedom from alcohol, pills, pot, or anything which affects you from the neck up. And if you are a regular attender of this meeting and would like to take a cake with us, please see me at the door before the meeting. We have some birthdays tonight, so let us sing briskly and speak briefly. Our first birthday is for 1 year for Vince P. Happy.
Good evening, I'm Vince, and I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to thank my God, Frank, for a wonderful year of sponsorship. My AA brothers, Clancy for the group, Clancy and Charlotte for the yard, and a special thanks to my stepmother, Joan, for coming out tonight to watch me take this cake, and all of you, thanks.
Vince. Now we have a one-year birthday for Sean P.
Hi, my name is Sean Peterson. I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to thank God. I'd like to thank Nina for sponsoring me for this whole year and for giving me a cake. Classic in all of you.
Happy birthday, Sean. And now we have another one-year birthday for Majid H. Happy.
Good evening. My name is Majid. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
I'd like to thank God for the gift of sobriety, Hamid for his sponsorship, Clint H., Dan S., Clancy for the structure, and all of you.
Happy birthday, Majid. Now we have a two-year birthday for Melissa S. Happy.
Melissa, alcoholic. I'd like to thank my sponsor, Karen, for giving me my second cake, her sponsor, Clancy, and all of you.
Happy birthday, Melissa. Now we have a three-year birthday for Christine D. Happy.
My name is Christine, and I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to thank Mary for giving me this cake, Lindsay for allowing me to take this cake, AA as a whole, and all of you. Thank you.
Happy birthday, Christine. Now we have a four-year birthday for Jimmy C. Happy.
Hi, my name's Jimmy, and I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank Karen, Clancy, my AA sisters, Mr. Wayne B., Lindsay for letting me take the cake, my sweetheart, our two kids, and each and every one of you. Thanks for my life.
Happy birthday, Jimmy. Now we have a four-year birthday for Kathy G. Happy.
And Kathy, I'm an alcoholic. I thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous, my sponsor, Marion, Karen Garrison for 3.5 years of sponsorship, Pacific Group, and Clancy and all of you. Thanks.
Happy birthday, Kathy. Now we have a four-year birthday for Lori C. Happy.
Hi, I'm Lori. I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to thank God, Rennie for her unconditional love, everything that she is, Kim Reisman for bringing me to the group, Clancy for the structure, my AA sisters, and all of you.
Happy birthday, Lori. Now we have a six-year birthday for Bill S.
My name is Bill, and I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to thank Lindsay for letting me take a cake. I'd like to thank God, AA, my sponsor, Ed, my lovely wife, Karen, Clancy, and all of you. Thank you.
Happy birthday, Bill. Now we have a seven-year birthday for Julie St. J. Happy.
Hi, everyone. I'm Julie St. John, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
I'd like to thank God, Diana Van Lanker in Minneapolis, for sponsoring me for 6 years. Rita for giving me that cake and taking my case on and already helping me so much. My family, my AA sisters, class of 91, and all of you.
Happy birthday, Julie. And now we have a seven-year birthday for Thor G. Happy.
Hi, my name's Thor. I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to thank Wayne for his sponsorship. I'd like to thank my previous sponsors, Vince and Bob. I'd like to thank my AA brothers and sisters. I'd like to thank Clancy and all of you.
Happy birthday, Thor. Now we have an eight-year birthday for Aaron E. Happy.
My name's Aaron Eichenlaub, and I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to thank God. I'd like to thank Byron for that cake and for another year of sponsorship. I'd like to thank Bill C. for his previous sponsorship, Clancy and Charlotte for the yard, the Pacific Group, Alcoholics Anonymous as a whole, my fiancée Kathleen for being a wonderful part of my life.
Happy birthday, Aaron. Now we have an A to your birthday for Kate McSee. Happy.
I'm Kate. I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to thank God. I'd like to thank my sponsor, Shannon. And I've never thanked anybody for structure, but I'd like to thank the Pacific Group.
Happy birthday, Kate. Now we have... Now we have a 10-year birthday for Hamid M. Happy.
Hi, I'm Hamid, alcoholic.
Hamid.
I want to thank God for grace of sobriety. I want to thank Tom for being in my corner past 5 years, making me take the steps. And I want to thank Dan Sherman for working with me this year. And I want to thank Clint and all the guys that call me sponsor. And they're the reason that I keep coming back, and I know that there is a... There's something I'm looking for, and I know I can find it here. Thank you.
Happy birthday, Hamid. Now we have an 11-year birthday for Joby W. Happy.
My name is Joby. I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to thank Marion for sponsoring me. I would be absolutely lost without her. I'd like to thank Byron for all of the help he gives to Chris and me. And I'd like to thank Clancy for this group and all the kindness that he has always shown me. And I'd like to thank my husband, Chris, for being such a good example. Thank you.
Happy birthday, Joby. Now we have a 12-year birthday for Mitchell N. Happy.
My name is Mitchell Noble. I'm an alcoholic. First of all, I'd like to thank God for your patience. I'd like to thank Clancy for being my sponsor in the bottom line on just about every issue that come up in my head. I'd like to thank Lindsay for being a great secretary and having speakers like Joe here. That lets me know that there's lots of answers here every time I come. I'd like to thank the sober runners that get out on Sunday morning, especially Tim M. in Ireland and Cheryl S. I'd also like to thank the chair commitment people here. And as another special announcement, Julie R. will be at the treasurer's table, and we need to get everyone that's on the chair commitment to sign our list, because it's been misplaced or restructured. So thanks a lot for everybody here as well.
Happy birthday, Mitchell. Now we have a 15-year birthday for Rodney S. Happy.
My name is Rodney Stillwag, an alcoholic. I want to thank Tim Curl for giving me that cake tonight, Matt Johnson for his sponsorship, Clancy for the group, Larry Garrity for getting here to come help me, and my mom and my daughter, Marilyn, Indiana, for coming here tonight and watching me get a cake. Thank you very much.
Happy birthday, Rodney. And that's all the birthdays. I know, but I've got excitement in store for you. We have $6 sent in for 6 years from Amy Fewings from Brisbane, Australia. Happy birthday, Amy. That is a total of 110 years, 18 birthdays, with an average of 6.1 years per birthday. We have a little custom in the Pacific Group of donating $1 for each candle on our birthday cakes, and at the end of the year, we send this candle money to our general service office in New York. Last year, we sent over $8,300, and if you would like to participate in this custom, then please see our treasurer, ZM, at the rear of the meeting, after the meeting, after the Lord's Prayer. And because we are stacked parked and we all need to leave quickly, please go quickly and pay for your candles.